And I tell you what, the older you get, and I'm a very old lady now, the older you get, the more you remember things more clearly from your youth than you do the things that happened about a couple or 3 years ago.
Again, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
I actually started the war before the war started, really. The Germans invaded Poland on Friday, the 1st of September, and I went straight that evening to the ARP offices in Baker Street, and I knew perfectly well that there was going to be a war, and I joined up with the ARP, and in fact, I never went back to my office at all.
On the Friday, I was working in the co-op. Now, we knew, by the way, Friday, you didn't finish till 8 o'clock at night. You got your pay on a Friday as well. I think I was on 8 and 4 pence a week, which was canny money for a lad. We knew that he had invaded Poland, and we knew that we would give an ultimatum. We didn't know what a bloody ultimatum was. Saturday, we knew that the was getting serious because we hadn't heard anything. We knew there was going to be a very, very, very important announcement on the wireless at 11 o'clock on the Sunday morning. So naturally, we're all listening. And it came on and it was Chamberlain.
Most people, including my family, were clustered around the radio. And Chamberlain's voice came on and said, "I have to tell you now that an ultimatum has been issued to Herr Hitler, and he has not responded. And as a consequence, we are now at war with Germany."
And I don't think it had been a minute later when all the sirens went throughout the country, as far as I can gather, throughout the country. But I know they definitely went in Baker.
And within 10 minutes of his announcement, there was an air raid warning in London, and nobody knew what the hell to do. And people were diving around in and out of shops, and mainly heading for the underground station at Baker Street. It was all quite interesting, really.
And I remember, oh my God, the hair already.
My poor old father, he just put his head in his hands. The ones I felt for on that day were the people of their generation. Whatever they felt was far, far greater than the people of my generation. And I was only 19.
For about 3 or 4 months, it was phony.
Although once the bombing started in 1940, it did get a bit different then.
A lot of the people whose husbands had been in the First World War had like little, not dugouts, but under the stairs was a little dugout where it was comfortable.
It was a brick-built thing with a concrete roof, a big steel plate on the side which bolted through both sides, and the bricks that between were merely packed in sand instead of cement, so we've got a hole to get out of.
But my mother had arranged for to get one of these steel tables where we could sleep underneath.
My grandmother had fairly uncomfortable recollections of being in Streatham during the First War and being bombed, and was firmly convinced we'd be wiped out in the sort of first week.
And there were some dreadful bomb incidents in the borough, of large numbers of people being killed and injured, and it was pretty dreadful. And I think it obviously became more serious to people as it went on.
Well, when it came to our area, I mean, it really hit home to us in my street, outside my front door, if you like. And that then I was terrified, absolutely terrified. And I think most people obviously were. But it was a dreadful, dreadful feeling of helplessness. What could I do? I remember my dad, my brother, who happened to be home on leave from the Air Force at the time. They both rushed out because it was right directly opposite us where these people were trapped. They rushed out and dug with their bare hands to get people out. The gas main in the middle of the road had gone up. The water mains had gone. The gas main, the fires were above the rooftops. And I remember my dad shouting to us, get back in. Well, the front door was blown in anyway, so we just tramped over it and got back in. And all we knew then was the next morning when my poor old mum was getting the curtains down, and I said, Mum, leave the curtains. She said, no, I've got to wash them. And when she got them down to wash, there were great big clumps of clay with blood in it.
I saw a lot of bomb damage and damage to human beings. I was lifted off my feet by a landmine, the explosion of a landmine in Maribyrn Road, which lifted me off my feet and threw me against a concrete pillar. It made it very personal as far as I was concerned.
The bombing, I've got to say it, it was uncomfortable, you were scary. But I don't think I was ever feared. Afraid, yes, but I hadn't that fear which I felt later on, I can tell you.
I think we had a fair idea what Nazism was. We'd seen signs of it in Spain with Franco, and also with the bombing that the Germans did of unprotected cities in Spain during that civil war. And I don't think anyone really doubted that this was something that had to be done.
Yes, these people are doing it all wrong. We mustn't have this. It's not right that one country should overwhelm and rule all the others. So, yes, it felt perfectly right about that. And the Japanese had invaded other people's territory, not least the attack on the Philippines, of course. Therefore, they were wrong, and therefore, they needed to be dealt with.
Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Bang, 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 goes the farmer's gun. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, 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 rabbit, run, rabbit.
I joined up the halfway through 1943.
April 15th, I was sent down to Brandsmouth Castle. After initial training, I went into the Duke of Wellington's regiment. I was kept back as a trained soldier for the next group, but it wasn't for an 18-year-old lad.
So in September 43, I was commissioned as a midshipman.
Well, I was in the military academy for pilots in Poland as a youth.
I'd been reading about the terrible things that had been happening in the North Atlantic, with merchant ships being blown up and destroyed, and men dying in the water and dying even in their lifeboats. And I really felt that this was something that I'd like to possibly be involved with if I could, the stopping of this situation. And I was commissioned as a sub-lieutenant RNVR in May 1943, the month in which I became 20 years of age.
After the training, we were where the Polish squadrons were formed. We had our own mechanics. Everything was self-sufficient by or supplied. All the services regarding Air Force by Polish crew.
A lot of the training is boredom, but by the Lord Harry, when you're in action, a lot of it becomes nearly a second nature to you. I've always reckoned in the services it's 60% boredom, 30% training, 9% action, and 9% action and 1% sheer terror. And the terror comes after the first time you've been in action.
Our job in life was not so much to escort convoys as to actively seek out areas where German submarines were known to be operating, where hopefully we could get at them. Somebody had to be doing it, and we were equipped to do it. We were equipped, we had the right ships, we had the right equipment, we had the right training, and we had the right frame of mind. We wanted to get these people and stop them sinking innocent lives, killing innocent men in ships going across the Atlantic. It was a dirty game, we thought, submarine work, and we didn't like them at all.
Polish squadrons, all our pilots were experienced. They flew in 1938 when Germans attacked Czechoslovakia. So Poland volunteered and fought Germans in there. Then in 1939, they had Polish invasion. They flew against Germans. And then when they came into France, they flew in France. So they had experience.
You were interdependent. And you sort of lived with that in mind, that you looked after each other regardless of rank or whatever else, because your own existence possibly depended on them.
You were frightened before you took off. You were frightened. Everybody, and if anybody tells you he wasn't frightened, he's telling lies.
In my group, we had 6 ships. And altogether, we lost 4 of them. So we lost men that we had known personally, blokes who we'd had drinks with and, you know, had partied with and had fun with, and they were dead in the water. And it's very much something that you're very conscious of.
Once you took off, well, all your fear is gone, because you were concentrating on a different thing.
You accepted the thought that, yes, you were going to get into some form of danger, but it wouldn't affect you. It would. You do have that sort of feeling that it's going to be the other bloke, not yourself.
But you always felt invincible in a way, that it wasn't going to happen to you. Which, of course, it did happen to us. I lost a lot of friends. But you never really lost the hope that you were going to be all right. But I believe that was only youth.
And this is what they heard, coming in on a wing and a prayer. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Though there's one motor gone, we can still carry on, coming in on a wing and a prayer.
Then we were told we were going to Normandy.
To Normandy.
Normandy.
On D-Day, we were taken back to the barracks that morning, and the Wren officer on the way in, we knew then that D-Day had started. The news had filtered through that D-Day had happened. And the Wren officer in charge of us then she halted us on top of a little hill beside the river to say a prayer for the boys who were going, all the ships were then going down to the south coast. And she halted us and said, we'll say a little prayer for the boys.
We didn't go in initially, so I didn't get too frightened. But we did ferry work between the UK and the Normandy beaches.
As we came ashore, the man on my right and the man on my left suddenly fell down. And I'm sure that machine gun must have sprayed right across. How it didn't get me, I just don't know. Perhaps I'm rather thin, and they never got me. They got the two men on my left and right, but not me. I thought then, oh, my God, what's happening now? And then when we got into the bocage country, as they call that area of Normandy, where they got thick hedges and deep ditches, that is where we struck really a lot of very unpleasant stuff. If you got through one of these hedges and you found something very nasty the other side.
Going in, I went through a hedge that was iced up. And as we went through it, six-barrel mortar came round. And it landed amongst her. It killed one lad. One lad, his arm was nearly off. He fell across me. The toe of my boot was taken off. I had a lump of shrapnel in my foot. The other two got up and walked away. Of course, I was wounded, sent back to England. But the writer to that story is, on the 12th of June, my battalion attacked Breville with the high ground. It was pretty vital that we took it, and the battalion lost 156 blokes. It's in the records. And the two lads that left were both killed. The two lads were both killed at Breville. One of them was young Stoney McBall. I volunteered to go back with him. I must have been pretty mad. I volunteered to go back. It made no difference because he took everybody back. But I'd actually volunteered, I got that.
The badge word, to my way of thinking of people of that generation, is courage. They faced danger. They were brave. They had fortitude. They were a different breed altogether.
Shine on, victory moon, and guide our loved ones home. Shine on, victory moon, across
the first we knew, actually, that the end of the war had happened was from Germany rather than from the Admiralty. This German-speaking officer of ours, Bill Mock, one of the telegraphists was monitoring the German frequencies, and he found himself listening to German plain language signal coming through, which of course he couldn't understand, but he took it down letter by letter on his pad, and Bill Mock was able to read it. And in fact, it was a plain language signal from Admiral Dönitz to all German naval units at sea, telling them that the war was over. This was, I think, on the 6th of May, telling them that the war was over and that they should surface and that they should surrender to the first Allied naval vessels that they came to. Now, that was the first intimation we'd got that the war was actually over.
When the announcement came, the war was over, I can remember going with friends of mine down to Regent Street, and there was no traffic. There was no traffic. The people swarmed the whole of the roads and everywhere. And I can remember in Regent Street, in the middle of Regent Street, there was a pianist who was very famous at that time, called Charlie Coons, and he was playing his piano in the middle of Regent Street. No traffic, just people.
We sort of raised a glass to the effect, well, thank God for that bit. But we were promptly sort of gathered together and reminded that the war wasn't over. So any euphoria was... It sort of evaporated fairly fast because we were out to deal with the rest of the war.
The war finished. 2 days after that, a transport pulled up with a Pegasus on. I seen the 61, that's our battalion. All airborne troops are going back to Britain, 5th Brigade. Gets back with a transport. Gets into Lark Hill, getting off the transport, and I says, Bill Nichols. He belongs to Seam Harbour. I says, well, Bill, that's it. We're through with the war's over. I says, thank God for that. We're finished. He says, get away and look in the gym. I went over to the gym. It was on the square. It was full of jungle green. No, that's when my heart really sank.
We were in Cochin when the European war ended, and were then sort of building up for the Japanese, to finish the Japanese war off, whichever way we were going to do it.
I came home and I told my dad, I says, now look, don't tell me mother until I'm going away. But he told her the night before I was leaving. She went mad. You've been wounded twice, you've done your bit, mother. I said, what do you want us to do, desert? You know, it was stupid. In one way, the same as when I'd been wounded and I volunteered. When you're out of it, you want to be in there. When you're in there, you would love a little wound to get you out on a normal basis, but that's it. Anyway, out to India, the war was still on.
That in August, I think it was, in August 1945, they dropped the atom bomb, or two atom bombs, and that was the end of the war in Japan.
I don't think we understood or could appreciate the enormity of it.
People really didn't know what the hell it was. I mean, they knew it was something absolutely ghastly.
Just aware that, that there was this weapon, and it was sufficient to cause the Japanese to give up. I don't think we really understood just what it amounted to and what it implied. Just grateful.
The feeling of relief and joy overrode everything, but I believe most people really couldn't believe that it happened.
For the first 3 months, it was one of the most awkward transitions in my life. I went back to my job. I only took about 6 weeks off. Then I went back to my job behind the counter, just around the corner, yeah, shop just around the corner there. Hadn't a clue. Working with lads the same. The man that was the manager then had been me foreman when I was at Chilly Road, Mr. Arnold, another gentleman. No, Billy, when I come back from Gallipoli, I had the same trouble, and I know what you're going to, you know, it was one of these sort of things. We're going through. I must admit I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder. I couldn't get away with it. 6 weeks before, if I told the bloke to jump, he jumped. Therefore, I went in and somebody says, what are you then standing there? Hey, get yourself on. I had to do it. Well, I had got to. I didn't get the finish. And the crux of it come one day. I was in, and this woman came in, and she gave us a ration book that you had to take points out of. Well, I had an idea of the ration book, because the lads were showing us. But I wasn't sure, because tea was on the cupping, But so was these other coupons, but they had numbers on and there were points. And you bought a tin of stuff, cost so many points, you took the points off. And I turned to Eddie Timlin, who had been in the Navy. I says, Eddie, what? I says, which one? Do I cut a strip off and give them some? No, no, you cut half up. And this woman grabbed the book office. Give us it here. My son's away fighting for the likes of ye. Oh, that did it. Jody Ardercuff storming out the office. Billy, Billy, I'll have the same when I come back from Gallipoli once again. I'm afraid I've blotted me copybook.
There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover tomorrow. Just you wait and see.
I feel very emotional, extremely emotional.
Well, when I see them wearing the poppies, they're remembering young Stoney, young Pooley.
You think of your mates. You think of your mates. That comes to you naturally. For me, in the evening or at night, I think of them. Some, I mean, we were not only Poles, but also English, Australian, Canadian. We've been together.
War is not a glamorous pastime, as some people think. War is savagery, is what it is. Real war, I mean, real combat, it's just savagery.
I wear my medals with pride, as they say, you know. I put them on Remembrance Sunday. It's the only day of the year they ever go on. Then that's when I really start thinking about it and the people I've known and the people I've lost. My brother, of course, and all the blokes I knew in various ships who lost for no very good reason except that they were doing what they had to do.
The waste of life and the memory of various people who you lose is still there. So, and it's always at that last sort of moment when the bugles play and for the last post, and of course the reveille. It's in that period that still bites. I still quite literally get a lump in my throat and wipe the eye occasionally.